From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the missing Malaysian passenger jet. Atrocities reported in northeastern Nigeria, helping the displaced from the Central African Republic. Plus, Viktor Yanukovych again insisting he's Ukraine's real president. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Malaysian military is backing away from reports that it tracked a missing passenger jet far away from its intended flight path, casting further doubt on the plane's whereabouts. In a statement Wednesday, Air Force Chief Radzali Daud said he could not rule out that the Malaysian Airlines jetliner veered drastically off course, but he said a media report that claimed the military tracked the jet over the Strait of Malacca was clearly an inaccurate and incorrect report, in his words. The strait is off the west coast of the Malaysian peninsula and is hundreds of kilometers from where civilian air traffic controllers lost contact with the Boeing 777. The initial search for the plane had focused mainly on the South China Sea, which lies off the eastern coast. The plane, with 239 people on board, disappeared from civilian radar without any distress calls about an hour after leaving Kuala Lumpur Airport on its way to Beijing early on Saturday. The head of Interpol says the disappearance of the jet does not appear to be related to terrorism, but John Brennan, the director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, said he would not rule out that possibility. Meantime, at airports in the region, many travelers remain nervous. Hu Wei Sin was waiting to board a plane at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport where Saturday's flight took off.
Frankly speaking, I feel about. I'm feel worried about it. Yeah, I feel troubled. You know, to because it's only happened about, you know, 3-4 days ago. So it's not that peaceful actually.
About 2/3 of the people on board were Chinese nationals, with the remainder from Asian countries, Europe, and North America. For up-to-date coverage of the search for that missing Malaysian air jet, check out our website at voanews.com. Also in the news, ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych read a brief statement on the crisis in Ukraine on Tuesday in his second public appearance since fleeing to Russia in late February. Michael Eccles in Moscow has our report.
The massive click-clack sound from press photographers forced a smile on Viktor Yanukovych as he entered the conference hall. 8 minutes later, the ousted president turned and left, taking no questions. In the interim, he made his case.
В стране действует банда ультранационалистов и неофашистов.
A group of ultranationalists and neo-fascists is at work in Ukraine to put the country's army under the banner of Bandera and start a civil war, Mr. Yanukovych said. Stepan Bandera was a highly controversial World War II-era Ukrainian nationalist leader with ties to the Nazis. Mr. Yanukovych criticized the United States for promising monetary aid to Ukraine's new government.
Я намерен обратиться в Конгресс, в Сенат и в Верховный суд.
He said he would appeal to the U.S. Congress, Senate, and Supreme Court to assess the legality of giving such aid, insisting that U.S. laws prohibit it from giving money to what he called bandits.
Остаюсь не только единственным легитимным президентом Украины, но и верховным главнокомандующим.
Mr. Yanukovych also insisted that he remains Ukraine's only legitimate president and its commander-in-chief, and that he would soon return to Kyiv. However, given that Mr. Yanukovych has been dismissed as a political corpse by Russian President Vladimir Putin, and that in Ukraine there is a warrant for his arrest on charges of mass murder, it is unclear what sway the ousted president has in the ongoing crisis. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
Here in Washington, President Obama hosts Ukraine's interim prime minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk at the White House later today. White House says the president will stress his strong support for the Ukrainian people and talk about economic aid. U.S. has already pledged $1 billion in support to Ukraine. Crimea's regional government is going ahead with plans to hold a referendum on breaking away from Ukraine and joining Russia. But with Russian troops and pro-Russian self-defense forces in control of the peninsula, those in favor of Crimea remaining in Ukraine say it couldn't possibly be a fair vote. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Crimea's regional capital, Simferopol.
Crimea's pro-Moscow politicians have been out rallying support for Sunday's referendum, giving the people of the Ukrainian peninsula a choice between joining Russia or restoring Crimea's 1992 constitution and its status as an autonomous republic of Ukraine. Russia! Deputy Sergei Tsiakov, like all members of the new pro-Russia parliament, has come out in favor of uniting with Moscow.
No, me.
We will be happy in 1 week's time because we will do what we have been waiting to do for many, many years.
At this and other rallies, pro-Russia sentiment is strong.
I want for our Crimea to reunite with Russia. The Crimean land is Russia.
Crimea has a long history with Moscow, and the majority of its population is ethnic Russian. But with the region under the control of Russian and pro-Russian forces, the idea of any free and fair vote is to some absurd. While Russia denies any of its forces have moved beyond its leased bases in Crimea, columns of unidentified but widely believed to be Russian military vehicles move freely around the peninsula. Pro-Russian self-defense groups are now joined by new Crimean special forces, sworn in this week by the region's pro-Moscow prime minister in the name of ensuring stability ahead of the referendum. Refat Chubarov is a leader of Crimea's Tatar minority.
The most cynical thing in history is when people have to make a choice under the gun, when they are afraid about their children, their family.
Ukrainian leaders have condemned the vote, saying it violates national sovereignty, a position supported by Western allies, and should not be recognized as legal.
I'm absolutely certain that this referendum could be recognized by North Korea and probably Syria, and that's about it. We are appealing to Russia, the Russian Federation, to cancel immediately the referendum, which is going to take place on the territory of the Crimean Autonomous Republic, which is an inseparable part of Ukraine.
But such words so far appear to have made very little difference to what's happening on the ground. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Simferopol.
And now to Kiev, where Jamie Detmer reports that Ukraine's intelligence chiefs are recommending against signing a 1994 landmark international agreement to swap thousands of nuclear weapons for promises from Russia to observe Ukrainian independence.
The former head of Ukraine's external intelligence service, Mykola Mamush, says Ukrainian security chiefs feared Russia would eventually try to seize Crimea and urged the country's then-president, Leonid Kuchma, to demand an enforcement mechanism for the 1994 Budapest Memorandum before signing it. He says intelligence chiefs warned that the agreement signed by the US, Russia, Britain and Ukraine failed to provide legally binding assurances. The Western powers and Ukraine say Russia has broken the agreement by invading Crimea. The Budapest Memorandum committed all parties to refrain from the threat or use of force against Ukraine's territorial integrity. But the agreement is not a treaty and doesn't require any of the signatories to do anything in the event of violations. Malmush, an army general who's advising Ukraine's interim government, says he and other Ukrainian security and military chiefs have been talking behind the scenes with their Russian counterparts since Russia seized Crimea to find a way to resolve the crisis. And he says Ukrainian forces are being moved to the east of the country to deter any further aggression from Russia. Ukrainian forces will continue to show restraint and only fight if there are further Russian encroachments into Ukraine or if the lives of soldiers are threatened. But the slow deployment of Ukrainian forces has earned the reproof of the leaders of the Maidan uprising. One of them, Sergei Pyokov, says the interim government has been too slow in response to Russia's land grab of Crimea.
It seems like they have behaved very passively to the situation. We don't understand why they are really not doing anything, decisive.
While not calling for a firefight, Pyotrkov and other leaders of the uprising that ousted President Viktor Yanukovych last month believe Ukraine's interim government...
They could block the approach to the Crimea and even the part of the Crimea with our own army. We could stay the like a line of defense about, you know, the half of the Crimea.
With a referendum of Crimea's future just days away, the tension is mounting. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Libya's parliament has ousted the nation's prime minister in a no-confidence vote after a North Korean-flagged tanker that illegally loaded crude oil at a rebel-held eastern port reportedly reached international waters. Angry deputies in the General National Congress, Libya's highest political authority, Tuesday named the country's defense minister, Abdul Attani, as the interim prime minister until a replacement for Ali Zidane can be found. The move was prompted by news that the tanker had taken advantage of poor weather conditions to escape naval ships escorting it to a government port and head for the open sea. There was no immediate reaction from Mr. Zidane on his ouster. Most politicians in Libya are backed by militias with regional or ideological allegiances, and many are not likely to accept his removal. Also in the news, Ethiopia's prime minister believes a fast deployment of regional troops to South Sudan is important so that South Sudan does not turn into another failed state. Marta Vanderwolf has our report.
South Sudan and regional stability were the main points discussed Tuesday as Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta began his first state visit to Ethiopia. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn says deployment of a regional stability and protection force to South Sudan should not be delayed.
It will be very bad to have a failed state again in our region. So we urge the international community to respond as quickly as possible to our requests so that we rescue this country.
Several East African countries, such as Kenya, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Djibouti, and Burundi, have indicated they are ready to send troops to South Sudan. Nearly 3 months of fighting has left thousands dead and close to 1 million displaced from their homes. The East African bloc IGAD is mediating peace negotiations between the government and rebel forces in Addis Ababa. Despite the signing of a cessation of hostilities agreement in January, fighting continues and the talks are making little progress. Heads of state from East Africa will meet Thursday in Addis Ababa to discuss the details of the proposed stabilization and protection force. Kenya and Ethiopia are also discussing the issue of 11 political detainees arrested by South Sudan's government in mid-December. Rebels want the 11 men released. 7 were turned to the Kenyan president's custody last month, but 4 remain imprisoned and will have to appear in a South Sudanese court. Kenyan President Kenyatta says the issue of the 4 detainees is key to resolving the issue.
As part of our own IGAD framework, we had indicated that we would want to see ourselves work towards the release of the 4 to join the 7 and everybody else in finding a political solution to the crisis. And that is a process that we are continuing to pursue with Juba.
President Kenyatta is scheduled to remain in Ethiopia through the IGAD summit on Thursday. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Central Africa, Abu Musa, has called for a global response to help the region cope with an impact from the crisis in the Central African Republic. Musa says the sectarian violence in the CAR has put a heavy burden on the country's neighbors. He says the number of refugees continues to increase, arms trafficking is at an all-time high, and there is total disrespect for human dignity. Musa told VOA he was visiting Central African countries to find out how they could jointly manage the fallout from the CAR.
The Secretary General is very concerned about issues ranging from individuals who are not Central Africans who are transiting through here. We have the high rate of malnutrition along the border. We have refugees. We have the issue of the threat of Boko Haram and other terrorist groups, rape of children, name it. You have all these problems, and they deserve attention.
The UN envoy was in Yaoundé, the capital of Cameroon, on Tuesday after Cameroon had rejected allegations that warring groups in the CAR, members of the Nigerian radical sect Boko Haram, and some terrorist movements were using the country's territory as training ground. Moussa, who refused to comment on those allegations, did tell VOA the issue will be submitted to the United Nations Security Council.
You can be in a better position to help on two grounds. One, to raise awareness that something is going on somewhere. And second, you can formulate a global strategy on how best to support the government. And I'll be going back to report to the council on my findings.
According to the government of Cameroon, the number of CAR refugees in the country has increased from 50,000 to 150,000 over the past 2 months. Thousands of people have fled northeastern Nigeria in recent weeks amid reports of atrocities against civilians there. The UN Refugee Agency says it is increasingly alarmed at the rising level of violence. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says the latest attacks began in mid-February.
Over the past 4 weeks, we've seen an additional 2,000 people fleeing this region into the southeast of neighboring Niger. The accounts from these people speak of real atrocities in the region around Lake Chad, which lies on the borders between Niger, Nigeria, and Chad. One woman described to us bodies being strewn through houses, floating in the water.
Many people said they were too afraid to stay behind and bury the dead or look for missing relatives.
We've had some other accounts of a shooting in villages there with women and children being kidnapped and taken away. So it's really a spreading of this horrible conflict we're seeing outside of the town and into some of the rural areas of northeast Nigeria.
Besides the Lake Chad area, some of the new arrivals are from the Borno state capital, Maiduguri.
It's hard for us to get full visibility of the situation inside northeast Nigeria simply because we don't have the access. And you have to remember that in addition to people fleeing Nigeria, you have got close to 500,000 people internally displaced inside the country, and that's according to the government's figures. So these are really very high numbers and reflect what seems to be a very alarming situation.
Since Nigeria declared a state of emergency in Adamawa, Yobe, and Borno states, nearly 60,000 people have fled to Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. Most are in Niger. About 17,000 of them are registered as Nigerian refugees. The rest are nationals from neighboring countries who've been living in Nigeria for many years.
We're working together with partners, including the International Rescue Committee, the governments of the neighboring countries, to try and ensure that countries keep their borders open. And then we're trying to do what we can to help people on arrival.
Edward says many of those fleeing northeastern Nigeria are traumatized and left with very few possessions. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Ugandan activists on Tuesday filed a petition in the Constitutional Court challenging the country's new anti-homosexuality law. Hillary Hewler has more now from Kampala.
The petition, filed by the Civil Society Coalition on Human Rights and Constitutional Law, challenges the act on a number of grounds. Among other things, it says the act violates the principle of equality and non-discrimination, that the penalty of life imprisonment is disproportionate, and that the bill was passed without a parliamentary quorum. It also asks that the media be prevented from publishing the names, pictures, and addresses of alleged homosexuals, following a spate of public outings in local tabloids. Petitioner Fox Odoi, a member of parliament, says he's helping to challenge the law as a matter of political conscience.
There's only one thing I fear, living in a society that has no room for minorities. I will not, by the grace of God, live in a society that does not respect and protect people who are different from the majority.
The act, signed by the Ugandan president last month, punishes certain homosexual acts by life in prison. It also criminalizes promotion of homosexuality and aiding and abetting homosexuality. One petitioner said at least 10 arrests have been made in Kampala since Parliament passed the bill in December, and a number of people have been evicted from their homes. Civil liberties lawyer Nicholas Apio, one of the petitioners, says that although their case is strong, it's still possible that the court could bend to Ugandan public opinion and uphold the controversial law.
Ordinarily, they shouldn't take that into account, but we know that in practice, it is possible for the courts to be persuaded by popular public outcry. But we trust that the courts will, in this case, concentrate and look at our pleadings and make a decision on the basis of the pleadings before it.
Odoi says the group has asked for an injunction to prevent the law from being enforced while the case is before the court. But, he points out, for now the law remains in effect. The law has been condemned by human rights groups, the United States, and several European nations. At least three countries, Norway, Denmark, and the Netherlands, have said they'll stop aid to the Ugandan government because of the law. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
Friend of Oscar Pistorius testified in the Olympian's murder trial in South Africa on Tuesday that the athlete twice fired weapons for which he is charged with firearms violations. Pistorius denies guilt in both of those events, which took place before he shot and killed his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, on February 14th of last year. Pistorius admits to shooting Steenkamp, but says he thought she was an intruder in his home. Prosecutors allege Pistorius murdered his girlfriend after the two had a heated argument.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
Here in Washington on Tuesday, U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Director John Brennan said the spy agency did not hack into computers the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee was using to investigate Bush-era interrogation programs.
As far as the allegations of, you know, CIA hacking into, you know, Senate computers, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, we wouldn't do that. I mean, that's just beyond the scope of reason.
And earlier on Tuesday, Intelligence Committee head Senator Dianne Feinstein spoke on the floor of the Senate.
Based on what Director Brennan has informed us, I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution, including the speech and debate clause. It may have undermined the constitutional framework essential to effective congressional oversight of intelligence activities or any other government function.
Feinstein said the CIA Inspector General referred the matter to the Justice Department for investigation of a possible criminal violation by the CIA personnel. The CIA provided the computers for the panel to review millions of pages of top secret documents during its investigation into the CIA's alleged use of torture. And one last item for you. 8 days and 13 hours after he began, the winner has crossed the finish line in the nearly 1,500-kilometer-long Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Picking up his second win, Dallas CV drove his dog sled across the finish line on Tuesday in Nome, Alaska. He came from behind to pass four-time winner Jeff King. CV became the youngest Iditarod champion when he won the 2012 race at the age of 25. Many thanks, everyone, for checking us out today here on the Voice of America for International Edition. You can also find us on the internet at voanews.com. Check us out there, why don't you? Stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On March 12, 1912, the Girl Scouts of America, then known as the Girl Guides, was formed in Savannah, Georgia, by Juliet Gordon Lowe. On this day in 1925, physician, revolutionary, and political leader Sun Yat-sen died. He is known as the father of modern China and was revered by both the communists and the nationalists. Sun helped overthrow the Qing dynasty and became the Republic of China's provisional president in 1912. He was one of the founders of the Kuomintang, the Chinese Nationalist Party. In 1930, Indian human rights leader Mahatma Gandhi led a demonstration known as the Salt March to protest the British monopoly on salt. It highlighted Gandhi's tactic of nonviolent civil disobedience. In 1933, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt began a series of 30 radio broadcasts to the American people that would become known as Fireside Chats. Mr. Roosevelt used the messages to explain his policies during the Depression and the Second World War. In 1938, German troops marched into neighboring Austria to annex the nation into the Third Reich. In 1947, President Harry Truman, in a speech to a joint session of the U.S. Congress, requested aid for Turkey and Greece. Greece was facing a communist insurgency, and Turkey was trying to resist Soviet pressure to share control of the Dardanelles Straits. The so-called Truman Doctrine was the first in a series of steps to try to contain Soviet influence. And on March 12, 2003, reformist Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic was assassinated. He was responsible for handing former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic over to international war crimes authorities. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late February, the U.S. Department of State released its annual country reports on human rights practices. The report, which covers almost 200 distinct countries and territories worldwide, is mandated by the U.S. Congress. The Human Rights Report is not just some high-minded exercise, said Secretary of State John Kerry. This is the most comprehensive, authoritative, dispassionate, and factual review of the state of human rights globally. A number of clear negative trends continued in 2013, specifically the tightening of restrictions on private citizens and civil society as a means of stifling dissent. Governments in every region of the world continued to restrict citizens' universal rights to exercise freedoms of assembly and association. They passed new legislation to silence political dissent and used excessive force to crack down on civil society and peaceful protest. Many governments continued to restrict free expression, online and off, targeting journalists and media outlets to control or eliminate political criticism and opposition. Members of security forces unlawfully arrested, raped, tortured, and killed protesters and dissidents, frequently with impunity, as governments refused to make them accountable for their acts. A number of governments fail to protect their citizens from exploitation, ignoring deplorable and unsafe working conditions, leading to injury and deaths. Workers' attempts to organize and bargain collectively were frequently impeded by governments' failure to enforce labor protections, as well as government interference in their activities and violence and threats against labor leaders. And finally, governments subjected members of marginalized groups, such as religious and ethnic minorities, women and children, LGBT persons and persons with disabilities, to repressive policies, societal intolerance, discriminatory laws, and disenfranchisement, and failed to hold accountable those who committed crimes against them. The United States of America will continue to speak out without a hint of arrogance or apology on behalf of people who stand up for their universal rights, said Secretary of State Kerry.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.